Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
I still call on people, everyone, frankly, to envision new possibilities, not just for the AIA, but for the profession and for, you know, just the way that we conduct ourselves and the way that we engage with our communities, with our clients. I think, you know, it's time to look at things from a slightly different perspective. So I'm happy to bring, you know, my voice to the table, which represents, you know, some groups that have not long had a lot of representation.
Welcome to Context and Clarity, the place where authors, experts, and thought leaders come to have engaged conversations with entrepreneurial architects just like you. I'm Jeff Eccles, and every Thursday afternoon on Context and Clarity Live, Catherine McPhail and I, and our live audiences that are joining us from all across the internet, we have a conversation with a special guest to search for clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect, no matter what your context is. In this episode, we talk with Kimberly Dowdell, the 100th president of the American Institute of Architects, but only the seventh woman and the first Black woman to hold that position. Our guest today is an architect, a leader, and a visionary. She's a firm principal, a past president of the National Organization of Minority Architects, and will be the 100th president of the American Institute of Architects. As the 100th, she'll be only the seventh woman to be president, the first Black woman to be president, and the first from the millennial generation to be president. She asks us to envision new possibilities and focuses on supporting architects in practice, creating a sense of belonging, ensuring access to the architectural profession and education, addressing climate concerns and designing for the future, considering rapid technological advances. Kimberly Dowdell, welcome to Context and Clarity Live.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's good to be here, especially for your 100th. Congratulations to you.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And congratulations to you on being the 100th. And what we talked about before we get started, the 10-year anniversary of passing your last section of the ARE today. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yes, March 16th, 2013 is a very memorable day because had I not passed that day, I actually would have had to start all over because of the rolling clock.
Oh, wow.
Thankfully, NCARB actually changed that policy recently. It hasn't hit all jurisdictions yet, but we're actively working with our partners throughout the industry to make sure that that happens. So it's a milestone that I'm I'm excited about, but also interested in helping to make possible for more people.
Which section did you lead for last?
The last section was building design and construction systems.
That's a really timely anniversary, I guess, because of that rolling clock issue. You know, I think that's a great illustration that it's been all over social media and articles and everything about the NCARB, removing the rolling clock, I guess. I don't know if anybody identified with that issue as closely as you do or you did because of that situation. I mean, that's kind of bonkers to think that had you not passed on, you know, 10 years
ago. I wouldn't be sitting here as your 100th.
Yeah, that's really crazy.
Guest. Wow. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
here we are.
Well, I'm glad you did.
Here we are. Well, yeah, exactly.
Me too.
Yeah, congratulations on that. So You know, in the introduction, I rattled off all of these things that kind of come together in you, the 100th, the seventh woman, the first Black woman, the first millennial, all of those things. Obviously that, well, maybe I shouldn't say obviously, but I think that probably gives you a pretty unique perspective coming into the position of the president of the American Institute of Architects. What's on your mind as you head towards what inauguration would be in December of this year, right?
December 15th.
December 15th. So what goes through your mind, you know, with that particular perspective as you get ready to take over from Emily Grandstaff Rice? We had her as our guest back in December. I think it was right after, I think the week after the inauguration for her tenure. What goes through your mind as you're thinking about all of those mantles that you're carrying, but also your vision for being this next and 100th president?
Yeah. You know, I think about the fact that I didn't get here alone. And, you know, I have so many, you know, people to thank for their support, you know, mentorship, sponsorship, guidance, all kinds of things, you know, Emily included in that for sure. But, you know, the other presidents of the AIA, you know, from all different varieties of types of people, the former presidents of NOMA, you know, certainly my firm has been super supportive. So that's the first thing. That's just a sincere sincere gratitude for all of that. But also thinking about, you know, the folks who've not yet decided to become an architect, the young people who are on the fence, or maybe they don't know about it yet. And hopefully, you know, as a profession, we'll do more to get the word out. But those who are on the fence, how do we make sure that we get them to choose architecture and stay in architecture? So talent attraction and retention is something that that I think a lot about. And I think about ways that we can, you know, really promote the work that we do and the value that we create so that we can really get the greatest talent that's out there. Because I like to say architects can see the future and help our clients create a better one. But it is a somewhat unique skill set to be able to, you know, to some extent see the future and then articulate it and draw. I mean, like, that's fairly rare. Like, most people can't do what we do. And we have to acknowledge that, and it needs to be valued more. But I think making sure that young people see this as an option as early as possible, and then cultivating that talent to really help our profession become even greater. So those are things kind of thinking about the past and the folks who have gotten me to this point, but then also what can I do, you know, among others to help those who are coming behind us.
Yeah, I love that. And as I mentioned in the introduction, one of the things that you focused on is sort of accessibility of education and the profession. And that's one of the things that I've been teaching for a handful of years now. And one thing that's really touched me is, you know, we talk a lot about path to licensure. You know, that's a term that's all over the profession. And I prefer a different term. I think path to the profession is something that I prefer, not trying to diminish licensure for any reason or at all. But I see so many people that accessibility issue is real, you know, whether it's the cost of school, the length of school, the, you know, all the things that go into it. So, you know, I assume that your passion for that is probably based on your experience in some way, but as we think about that accessibility, what do you think is really important for us to address in, you know, maybe in the next 5 years or something like that?
Yeah. Well, as I alluded to just before, making sure young people know what architecture and, you know what architects do, know what architecture is about as early as possible. So I'm talking like K-12 education, empowering, you know, our architecture centers around the country and even globally to find ways to get content into kids' hands. So actually yesterday I visited the IIDA's headquarters here in Chicago, and they had a book signing for a kid's book called Design Your World. And you know, I talked to someone there who said, yeah, you know, here at IIDA, we, you know, we have a small but mighty staff, and there's no way for us to get to all the schools. And so we decided to create this book to, you know, put that in kids' hands and, you know, start to plant those seeds about design in general. And I think, you know, thinking about architecture specifically, I know NOMA's national chapter had a coloring book, which was a brilliant idea because it, you know, got people engaged and they were coloring, you know, pictures of buildings in Nashville by NOMA members. So I think, again, that early information is as a form of access, but then, you know, getting people to the right guidance counselors. In fact, there was conversation about informing guidance counselors about architecture so that they don't, provide any misinformation. Helping people navigate the different types of programs, you know, whether you do a 4+2 program or a 5 program or a 4+3 program, if you want to study something as an undergrad that is not directly related. And so there's so many different pathways. I can understand how someone could get confused and just, sidetracked, or they might look at compensation, starting out compared to some other professions and make a decision based on that, which I think is unfortunate. But that also means that as a profession, we have to think about how we can best articulate our value and sort of raise those numbers over time. So I think a great goal within 5 years is to have a higher starting salary, which means that everyone has to be elevated to the point where, we're really getting the compensation that supports the value that we create. Because again, we can see the future, not many other people can do that. Once someone chooses the profession, getting them into whichever academic program makes the most sense, making sure that they have, the right the resources to afford the technology and the books and the supplies, materials, et cetera, and then connecting them with the right internship opportunities and getting them connected with mentors. That's one of the reasons why, for me, NOMA was so important as a student as well as AIA. And I wasn't directly involved with AIS as a student, but I think that's also a wonderful resource for people who are in school. And, really investing time and energy into these organizations, because they really do provide a strong and important support system to get into the profession and navigate which career opportunities make the most sense. And I like the idea of not necessarily calling it just the path to licensure, because at the AI, we've been having conversations around a notion we're calling beyond buildings, because, as architects, we're often sort of assumed to be designing buildings, but we're actually designing solutions that are beyond buildings. And some of those things are certainly done by licensed architects, but other things are done by those who have this really intense unique training. And I think we have to value that as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. When we're you're talking about raising starting salaries, which means that fees will have to go up and things like that, and it's ultimately going to come back to, and maybe it even wraps back to the grade school kids, is what is the value of an architect? What is an architect? What does an architect actually do? So I love that idea of beyond buildings, because there's so much more impact that's possible, or not even that's possible, that just happens every single day. It's kind of is what you were saying anyway. But I like that. I like that approach a lot. And I know that some of the things that you care about are, future of cities really kind of envisioning new possibilities was a big part of your campaign, wasn't it?
It was. That was what I used as my hashtag for most of my social media posts last year during the campaign process. And, I still, call on people, everyone, frankly, to envision new possibilities, not just for the AIA, but for the profession. Just the way that we, conduct ourselves and the way that we engage with our communities, with our clients. I think, it's time to look at things from a slightly different perspective. So I'm happy to bring, my voice to the table, which represents, some groups that have not long had a lot of representation.
You're carrying the mantle as the first from the millennial generation to take this leadership role. What, as you think about that, how do you think leadership changes, or what do you think about different leadership approaches as we move forward? Because we've talked about this week. There always has been this natural shift, generational shift through leadership, right? As people get older and younger people come up, et cetera. I think we're in the first time in history with four generations in the workplace. And now you're taking this mantle. Does that signal, and I don't know, this is asking for a really broad brush answer, I guess, but is there a difference in the way that you're going to think about leadership, and maybe people that in your generation are going to think about leadership differently, things that we'll care about or
talk about or act differently than has been done in the past?
Sure. Well, first, I'd like to say I like all the generations. Everyone's wonderful.
Everyone.
Yeah, I'm not trying to pit generations against generations.
And I try not to make broad sweeping generalizations about any group of people, and certainly not generations. But I will say, I believe that the millennial, or also known as Gen Y generation, I mean, like how generations work, we're a bridge between Gen X, who are those who are a bit older than us, and Gen Z, those who are actually just now entering the workplace. And so I think that, you know, helping our Gen Z counterparts kind of get adjusted to, to sort of office culture and things of that nature, especially coming out of a pandemic, which, you know, was disruptive for all of us, frankly. But I think for them coming in and just trying to understand how all this works. And I think that's a big part of our role in the Gen Y millennial group. And then also helping Gen Xers and boomers understand how to not only, I think they're still trying to figure out how to work with us. I think they also think that we're still in our 20s, but we're actually 40 plus at this point, but that's neither here nor there. But I think it's about having conversations that bridge those gaps and help to create more understanding. I think there's also, again, generally speaking, more of an emphasis on sustainable design, sustainability, resilience. This isn't like the greatest reason, but I think it's because of Captain Planet. It's a really great cartoon. I personally watched it and was just like, you know, it's really important that we recycle, you know, like from being a little kid, like that was the thing. And, you know, there are other influences. Certainly that's one that comes to mind first, but there are other influences that I think that we saw coming up in the 80s and 90s that sort of made it really important that we take care of the environment, we take care of one another, we give back, we try to be philanthropic, but unfortunately student loans have impacted millennials more than actually Gen Z and Gen X. I guess there's some policy situation that made that the case. So, but generally speaking, I think it's about people, planet, and profit, whereas I think perhaps some of the earlier generations are a little bit more focused on profit, which makes sense. They came up, were with parents or grandparents that, you know, navigated the Depression and, you know, there are just different policy things that were in place and different things happening in the world, which informs our worldview. So I'll leave it there, but I think that broadly speaking, millennials are still trying to figure this thing out, but doing our best to, navigate our peers on.
One of the things that I did not mention, I mentioned in the introduction that you are principal at a firm, but I didn't even mention the firm. It's HOK. You're in the Chicago office at HOK. Our audience is primarily small firm architects. And so one question that naturally comes up all the time when whether it's Emily or we had Lakeisha Woods on a few weeks ago, the question that's always going to come up is, what about small firms in the future, not only of AIA, that's certainly in this context, but what about small firms in the future of the profession? As we, you know, if we go over to the Small Firm Exchange website, I'll call it, you get all the statistics that are there about the, you know, the percentage of employees, the percentage of firms, the percentage of architects that are small firm architects. Do you see small firms continuing to trend upwards? And if so, what's that mean for the future? Does it what's the impact of that on the future of the profession?
Yeah, I mean, I think that small firms will continue to flourish and will grow and obviously become a medium-sized firm and perhaps in the future a larger size firm. But some firm owners, they intentionally want to stay small and sort of work in a way that, that just kind of keeps them within, you know, maybe the, you know, 12 plus or minus people range, or even sole practitioners and everywhere in between. And I think that there's room for all types, because there are all types of buildings, there are all types of projects, whether they be, you know, built projects, and I talked about beyond buildings, but there are also some problem solving, efforts that or opportunities out there. I think specifically thinking about, working in the public sector, you know, sometimes city governments will, or state governments or what have you, will put out RFPs, RFQs for community engagement, or they'll, you know, have like, they'll pose a problem that, you know, architects or landscape architects or planners might be able to help with. And so I think having, you know, a wide variety of different opportunities to leverage design services will, you know, will be applied at different scales. And so I think small firms will always have a place in the ecosystem. You know, as you mentioned, HOK is where I work. In fact, I started HOK in 2008. So I've been there for a long time, although I did take an 8-year period of time to do grad school and some other other opportunities, including teaching and having a small practice of my own. So I actually have some experience, and I know how difficult it is, you know, to make sure that you are keeping up with cash flow, paying insurance. I didn't have any idea how expensive insurance was, by the way, and you know, like those kinds of things. But yeah, I returned to HOK in 2019 as NOMA president, and shortly thereafter, myself and a few others within the firm, we launched an initiative called HOK Tapestry, and you can learn more about it at hoktapestry.com. But essentially, it's designed for us to work with smaller firms. You know, basically people who might consult with us on a project. And so it's a way for us to, one, get to know who's out in the community. And these are firms of all types, but, you know, we do offer the opportunity for firms to tag, you know, if they have MBE status, WBE status, VBE status, et cetera. So that way we can do kind of a smart search to see who's out there, who, you know, has these certain certifications. And even if they don't have a certification, they're, you know, they're in the program, and we're able to work with them on special programming that, you know, that perhaps a large firm like HOK that's been around since 1955 can lend some expertise, or in some cases, some office space, or, you know, resources of different types. So really excited about Tapestry and being able to spend some time in my new role, which was just announced this week as HOK's Director of Strategic Relationships. So, but yeah, working closely with small firms is a part of that. But even if a firm does not work with HOK or another large firm, I think there's really an important place for small firms in the ecosystem of design services.
Congratulations on the new role as well.
Thank you.
HOKTapestry.com. Check that out. You mentioned resilience and sustainability a few minutes ago. And I mean, I mentioned when Scott Thrift said hi from San Francisco, how crazy it's been out there in San Francisco. I mean, we've got some, actually today, there's some major storms brewing up in the, in kind of the deep South right now. We're in the midst of some really crazy climate action in the last several weeks. When you think about the future and you think about addressing climate concerns, what do you think about, and what can we as a community of architects do? What's the best thing that we can do in order to start addressing those types of issues?
Yeah, well, one thing that comes to mind is the 2030 challenge to really get all of our, you know, design colleagues to figure out how to, you know, to comply with the dynamics of the challenge. But also it reminds me, and I only learned about this recently, so I had to write it down to make sure I got it right. So there's an architect by the name of Joyce Owens. Yep. And I don't know if you do.
Yeah.
But, well, it's news to me, but I'm happy to share. So five of the homes that she designed in Sanibel Island, they withstood Hurricane Ian, whereas all the other homes around were demolished. And I think that's, you know, such an important testament to, you know, just the design skill that she has to make sure that those homes were not demolished, or, you know, were not destroyed in that storm. And so making sure that our colleagues are equipped with the skills and knowledge and resources that they need to design really resilient structures. And so, you know, one of the things that the 2030 challenge that I mentioned, you know, that's about long-term action that helps with prevention. But then also what Joyce has been able to accomplish, that's sort of dealing with the situation that we are currently in. And so I think it's a matter of kind of dealing with it in both ways.
Yeah. Yeah. For anybody that's not familiar with Joyce Owens, the reason that I know about her is because this is going to be past tense. We used to vacation in that area. And where we went is annihilated at this point. Right. And so I've known about Joyce and known her work for a while, seeing it down there, seeing it under construction. And if you want an illustration of what Kimberly is talking about, just go to Instagram. I think her Instagram handle is, it may be JOA. It's just Joyce Owens Architect, I think. But JOA, find her Instagram handle and see these photographs. And if you've not seen any of the devastation of Sanibel and Captiva and Fort Myer, this area we're talking about in Florida, see the photographs of her projects, and it's stark. I mean, it is incredible. You've got, you know, her project, and the first one that comes to my mind is this beautiful modern white home that's sitting there, presumably, if you didn't know any better, in the middle of a war zone. Everything else is just literally destroyed around it, but yet there sits her project, and I think it's an incredible testament to her design, the quality of design and construction, and all those things. It's really sad. It's really sad to view it, but it is a great example of the quality or the value of an architect in that type of environment, that type of project. So it's funny that you brought that up, because I was just talking about her in a mastermind group about an hour and a half ago. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So,
and I agree, the situation itself is terrible. You know, what happened to so many people. Yeah. But for me, there's a sense of pride that, you know, there's a woman architect, mm-hmm. Who, and it's women's month. So,
absolutely.
Thought I'd highlight that. Just, you know, really proud of the fact that her work, you know, in conjunction with the construction partners that were involved, you know, that it was able to sustain that kind of situation. So
like I said, go seek out some photographs of that, because it's, if you ever want to point to what an architect can do, you know, it's sitting there in the middle of the desolation. So I think it's on us. I was thinking earlier, sorry to kind of backtrack a minute, but I was thinking earlier about those photographs from Joyce and thinking about that stark difference. And there's a part of me that looks at that, you know, with some heartstrings, because that's where we used to go. But that it's such an illustration. And I think we need to do more of this to demonstrate, right? It's the show, not tell, right? It's the demonstrate, right. not tell. And of course, we don't want to wish that on any situation, but I think we need to do a better job of highlighting the reality of what we're talking about here and the value.
And one other resource I would point to is the AI framework for design excellence. And so that's, you know, a resource that people can take a look at that gets into a lot of the different types of design excellence, which includes resilience.
And you can also go back and Catherine, I think this is maybe 3 months ago now, but we had Melissa Wackerly from AIA talking about sustainability at AIA. So you can go watch that episode with Melissa. She had a lot of great resources to share as well.
She's a wealth of knowledge. So glad to be able to get her to share. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just everything rattles off. It was impressive. Good resources there. Another thing that I know you focused on is the rapid change in technology, which, I mean, I don't know if anybody's paying attention, but GPT-4 just was released in the last
couple
of days.
It's hard to keep up with all this. Yeah.
It's
all happening so fast.
Wow, that is fast.
And by the way, Google has incorporated AI now in your Gmail.
Oh, I heard about that.
Yeah, so.
Of course they have. Yeah.
Yeah.
And talk about envision new possibilities. That, I mean, with technology, it's exciting, but it's also a little scary in the sense that if architects don't sort of get ahead of this stuff, we could potentially lose some market share. And so I think talking about these issues now and making sure that others don't sort of eat our lunch is an important thing. But I think overall, the potential is there. We just have to make sure we harness it appropriately.
Yeah, that'll make our lives easier, I think.
Yeah. To me, as long as we look at these things as tools, right? Because that's what they are. As long as we look at these things as tools and learn to use the tools, you know, that'll be to the distinct advantage. But it's, you know, for everybody out there that's designing in wood construction, you know, you're not going to tell the carpenter that they can only swing a hammer, right? They have pneumatic nailers and other more advanced, I guess you could say it that way, more advanced tools, right? That they've adapted to. And That's a very basic example, obviously. But what other types of, I mean, AI is, it's, you know, that's the on the tip of everybody's tongue right now. But what else do you see in terms of advancing technologies that you're thinking about?
I think also the metaverse is something to be mindful of and how that works and how architects can get engaged. And the other thing, which isn't directly related, but there it's sort of tangential. There are many students who are studying architecture and taking classes, in the engineering building that, that are related to information sciences, et cetera. And some of them are getting very comfortable over there and getting poached by companies that are not architecture firms. And so we're losing some of our talent to those groups. And so I think, you know, it's not wrong of an architecture student to expand their horizons. I've certainly spent some time outside of traditional architecture. But I think that, you know, as a profession, we have to probably provide some opportunities for more immersion in technology or emerging technologies in particular to kind of keep the interest of some of our young people who are curious about what's happening, you know, over in Silicon Valley. So that comes to mind.
Yeah, that was one of the things. I taught an undergrad section of pro practice for the first time last semester. One of the things that really struck me, I asked, you know, I wanted to get to the heart of what these students were thinking about in terms of their future. You know, what do they think about in terms of the profession? What do they think about in terms of their career, their life? You know, all of these things, you've touched on a lot of them, right? The cost of education, debt, you know, all of those things, salaries, future workplace, things like that. And one day we were talking about what they were really interested in, you know, sort of types of jobs that they were interested in within or outside of the profession, you know, left that door open for them. And a majority of the students, and this is a small sample, right? It's 27 students or something like that. So it's a pretty small sample, but the majority of them said that they were interested in exploring something besides the traditional architecture practice. And so you had people talking about renderings and different, you know, visualization sort of technologies, building envelope designers. And, you know, I was impressed by some, you know, these are fourth year students. Like, okay, you've been exposed to some things that I didn't know about in my, you know, fourth year. But that really struck me that a lot of these students said, yeah, I'm not sold on the idea of traditional architecture practice, with at least the desire to explore other things that are out there.
Yeah, I certainly encourage young people. I mean, I did this myself. I've had many different jobs over the course of my career and, you know, sampling different things to see what makes the most sense, what makes you happy, like what's most fulfilling. Yeah. And so certainly trying those things out. But I would encourage folks to give traditional practice a try, just to at least know what it is and know what it's about. And, you know, the experience will certainly vary from firm to firm and you know, different firm cultures, you know, might impact one's decision to stay or move along. But definitely just having that information about what's out there is going to help, you know, help someone figure out where they probably would be most successful long term.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an excellent point. You've always got to bring that up with students, whether it's undergrad or grad, because at that point in their life, they have such a small small window of exposure, and you know, I don't know what I don't know, and they certainly don't know what they don't know. So finding a place that feels like home, I think, and feels, you know, accepting to you, that's one thing that a lot of these students were concerned about was, hey, they've heard stories, right? They saw the SciArc panel debacle, things like that. And they hear that and they're worried about that in terms of the workplace. You know, am I going to be thought of like that or treated like that? And some of it comes down to the right fit, and some of it comes down to us as professionals behaving badly or not, in my opinion. But I think there are legitimate concerns in that they don't know what they're headed into. How do we give the future generation of architects, how do we give them the feeling or reassure them that there is going to be a place here where you do belong, where, you know, you can build a career, that you can also have a family, that, you know, all of these things that I think many of us have aspired to when we were young, hopefully achieved as we've gotten older, but is there a key to facilitating those dreams, or is it just some natural thing that has to happen? I don't know.
Well, sort of how I kicked off my remarks earlier, it's for me, the key has been mentorship. And, you know, I tell everyone who, you know, I have the opportunity to chat with about my career. You know, I wouldn't be here without the great mentors that I've had, people who have, you know, just told me you should apply for this job, or, you know, there's an opening here, you should strongly consider it. You know, those are the kinds of things that, you know, based on their understanding of you and what you've articulated, that you're interested in. And also, it's important to be clear about what you want or things that you, you know, have an interest in seeing out, and then making sure that your network is aware of that, so that when those things do come around, others will think to tap you for those. But I, you know, I certainly credit my mentors from NOMA, from AIA, from HOK, and other places, you know, for helping to kind of guide me through all the various things that I've done throughout my career. And so I think asking questions and also being a mentor too, because there's a lot of good information from those who are coming behind you. So I think I like to call it 360 mentorship.
Yeah. I like that. We've talked about mentorship some on Context and Clarity, and that idea has come up, right? It's not just an older person mentoring a younger person. There's lots of, whether you call it two way or 360, there's lots of opportunity in all directions. I think that's a really good point. Are you familiar with the Dan Sullivan question? Have you ever heard that?
I have not.
We're getting into the marketing weeds here, or sales weeds at this point, but Dan Sullivan is this, I'm going to call him sort of this marketing guru guy. And there's actually a book now called the Dan Sullivan question, but the question goes something like, imagine yourself 3 years from today. I'll paraphrase it, but imagine yourself 3 years from today and you look around and go, this is great. This has been a success. I'm happy with where I am. And then looking back from 3 years from today back to today, what will have had to have happened over the course of those 3 years in order to make that true? So let's modify that a little bit for your case. At the end of 2024, your time as the 100th president of AIA will be coming to a close. So imagine yourself in December, mid-December of 2024, looking back. What will have had to have happened over the course of your year as president of AIA for you to say, this is what I dreamed it would be, or this has been very successful, or I'm so glad that this happened in this way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've definitely been spending some time thinking about things along this line, so not completely off guard here. You know, I really want the profession of architecture to be elevated significantly in the sort of public eye. Like, I want people to know what architects do. You know, actually, we went to Capitol Hill as AI for AI Leadership Summit last month, and we got to meet with some lawmakers and their staffers. And one of the questions that I asked, I think, in every group that I got to meet with, what's your favorite building? And most regular people, as in non-architects, they don't know. They don't know what their favorite building is, nor would they know the architect. And so I'd love it if there is heightened awareness of buildings in general, like the names of buildings. Certainly, it'd be great to know the architects of those buildings. And so I'd love it if, you know, as you're flipping through magazines, you start to see those things noted, because, you know, they're pretty good at putting the photographer's name. And I'm like, what building is this? Who's the architect? Like, I'd like for us to, you know, get a little bit more credit for the incredible amount of work that goes into creating these buildings. So I mean, just generally raising the profile of the architect. And so the work that will need to happen between now and then is really getting out there, telling our stories, you know, going on social media and, you know, the more traditional media channels, and just letting the public know what we do, the value that we create. And, you know, certainly it would be too early to see this come to fruition by the end of 2024. But, you know, I'd love to see those starting salaries become more competitive with other choices that young people have, so that more people will choose architecture. And it's a more complicated answer than I would have time, or actually right now the full understanding to address, but there are a lot of dynamics at play in, how we value our services. And also just generally the value that other people see, when they think of an architect. And so, so I think we have to work on that and kind of get our messaging straight and put it out there in a clear way so that our clients are like, oh, absolutely, this invoice makes sense. Like, do you want more?
I'm going to give you more.
Yeah. And also just one last thing on that topic, improving the procurement process for design services. Mm. The work that I have been doing up until my new role started this week is I've been marketing principal in the Chicago studio of HOK, and myself and my colleagues from around the firm, and also I know other firms deal with this too, receiving RFPs, RFQs, and other types of requests with very short turnaround times. Mm-hmm. We had something that was due on December 27th, which is, problematic for so many reasons. Even things due on Monday, it's like, because then people are going to be working over the weekend, and just kind of making sure that there are clear guidelines that treat us with a level of respect as mm-hmm. professionals. I think sometimes these RFPs and RFQs read like they're purchasing paperclips, and it's like, no, we are professionals, and it takes time to put these packages together. So really, I think improving the procurement service or the procurement professional services process would be something that I would like to say we accomplished over that year of my president.
I'm with you. We could talk for a couple of hours about that.
Yeah. It's something everyone can relate to for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Those are a couple of really, or a few really great goals there. I like all of those. And I think everybody in this community, anybody that's watching this either now or in the future, could get on board with all of those. So I know we're close to the top of the hour here. Again, an audience of small firm, primarily small firm architects from across the country. I don't know if I've seen any international friends pop in here today or not, but as you think about small firm architects or any architects, but this is our community, what's one thing that you would love it if every small firm architect in this community and beyond would start doing today?
I would encourage everyone to know your value and demand it. And if a client doesn't want to pay that, then maybe they're not the right client for you, and kind of like stick to your guns as much as possible. I know that's easier said than done, but I think as a profession, we have to do that consistently, like across the board, all sizes, all scales, like, you get what you ask for, generally speaking. And I think we have to be a little bit more generous with ourselves and understanding that our time, it takes on average 12 years for someone to become an architect, or at least that was a stat that I memorized a little while ago. Maybe the number has adjusted a little, but it takes a long time, basically. Yeah. Over a decade, roughly. And, you work really hard to earn that, and all of your colleagues, around you also did. And so I think it's important to make sure that that you are, earning your fees reflect that, so that you can actually continue to do that work and hire the best talent and keep the best talent. And so I think just being really confident in the services that you provide, that's really important. And the extent to which you need support or just generally want to connect with others to understand something that you don't know as much about, go to AIA, go to NOMA, go to other organizations like ULI, or depending on what you're directly engaged in, get involved locally or nationally or internationally. But, I think it's important to kind of build community around yourself, not just for your firm, but also with other firms, with other sole practitioners, with other large firms, like whatever the case might be, just building that network around you is really important. I think that's been one of the key things that's helped me, in addition to my mentors, which is kind of included in that group.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I love that idea of building the community around you. And I also think I'm going to maybe spin this in a different direction, perhaps. But I also think that none of us are on an island. None of us are insulated from any of this thing. We all bear some responsibility. We can't look at you know, this organization or that organization and say, oh, they ought to be doing this, because we have just, you know, back to Joyce Owens and the way, and she's sort of been on a speaking trail a little bit over the past couple of months too, talking about the situation down there in the Gulf Coast of Florida in the houses and everything else. She's taking that on, right? She's carrying that. Does it have some benefit for her? Certainly it does. Does it have a wider benefit for architects? Absolutely it does. In the ripple effect will no doubt be great. And so, you know, I think everybody needs to think about their own ripple effect and not say, hey, you know, what's AIA doing or what's NOMA doing or what's, you know, the rest of the alphabet soup doing for me. So those are some really great points. Kimberly, first of all, congratulations on 10 years.
Thank
years.
You.
That's an important one. Congratulations on being the 100th.
That's, thank you so much.
That's big. That's
huge.
That's pretty big.
Yeah. And thank you for being with us on our 100th.
Congrats to you.
Yeah. Thank you. We appreciate that, that synergy there. And so those of you that don't know this, you don't get to see the backside of planning and things like that. I tried to talk her out of it. I tried to tell her, no, you don't need to reschedule to make this happen. But I appreciate
it. I was determined. I was like, no, I'm going to make your 100th episode.
No, I appreciate that.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to have you here. It really is. We appreciate the support. Well, what do you think? Did you hear something in this conversation that you can use, maybe in your practice or even in your life? If the topic of this conversation is of particular interest to you, every week in the Entree Architect Network, I host the Context and Clarity Classroom. It's our weekly opportunity to take what we've learned from our special guests and put those lessons into action in your life and in your work. Find the Context and Clarity Classroom exclusively inside the Entree Architect Network at network.entrearchitect.com. And if you are so inspired by this conversation that you'd like to watch the entire Context and Clarity Live episode, head on over to YouTube. Find the Entree Architect YouTube channel. There's a playlist there that has all of the full Context and Clarity Live episodes. You can also have the Context and Clarity podcast delivered to you every week. Just give us a rating and subscribe wherever you're listening right now. Your likes and your ratings and your shares all help us help other entrepreneur architects like you. And together, they help us build the largest worldwide community of small firm architects. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's a multimedia network for people that care about the built environment. And it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know that you're going to find something there that interests you. You can learn more at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. So thanks for listening. I hope this conversation has inspired you to think about how you can build your business into something that allows you to practice the way that you want to practice.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glenn Gary. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.